Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Ellen. Thank you for being on today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We just talked a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. But before we dive into our big topic, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself?
Okay. Thank you, Jason, for having me. My name is Alan Scala. I am the program coordinator for the Fraxa Research Foundation. I started my career in fundraising, doing grant writing. And then from there, I've shifted through peer-to-peer and as well as monthly giving and kind of all things that encompass fundraising as a young professional. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And I really am passionate about the fundraising sector and the profession as a whole. So I'm really looking forward to talking with you about all that entails.
Yeah. So you and I met briefly on the in a book club sort of conversation. Excited to hear that you've read the book. But what I'm more excited to ask is because I know you're a young fundraiser, are you convinced now in sort of the current landscape and the current reality of the world and all that sort of stuff, and after perhaps reading my book and other books, is fundraising your thing? Are you going to stick it out? Is this what you're going to be doing 20 years from now?
Absolutely. I think so. I think I really enjoy reading about like what how the sector has changed over time, and especially with all the things that have changed in the past few months, and how in your book specifically, what really stuck out to me was arm's length fundraising and how it's so like more important now than ever to not do that and to really engage with your donors and have, you know, the conversations with them that get to know them and let them feel heard. And I think that, you know, that's going to keep changing as the months go on, and that, you know, it is something I really do value, and I really enjoy relationship building. And I think that's a key part of fundraising. And so, no, I absolutely would want to stay in this profession for 20 years plus.
Yeah. When I was writing that book, I was writing to, somebody who was about 5 to 10 years in, not somebody who was a longtime veteran, but who had sort of gotten beyond the fundraising 101 workshops and the tips and tricks and how-to books. And they were thinking a little more critically about, okay, does my identity align with this work? Do I want to get beyond, say, for example, this notion of arm's length fundraising? And can I think critically about sort of what it is I'm doing in order to sort of find meaning? I think if there's anything I've learned, Ellen, it's that there's a lot more joy and meaning to be experienced on our side of the table, figuratively and literally speaking, if we're doing that, you know, real meaningful engagement, if we're actually interacting with the donor. Have you experienced that?
Yes, absolutely. Especially when if a donor like hasn't heard from you for a while and then you reach out to them and reconnect, I think that's so fantastic also. It's really just a meaningful work all in general. Yeah, I agree.
So Ellen, what are we going to talk about today? I always invite my guests to come on. I don't take the lead. And anybody who knows me knows that I can ramble on and I can come up with all sorts of things to talk about, but I want to follow your lead. So what are we going to talk about today?
So one of the first books that I read to like kickstart my knowledge about fundraising was Born to Raise. And in that, it talks about all the things that great fundraisers need to have. And some of them were like limitless energy, hardworking, the ability to listen. So what are, in your opinion, some characteristics that make up a good fundraiser? Is there like some of those things that you think are the most important to have? Because personally, as a young professional, I want to know, you know, what do I need to succeed, or what are characteristics that I should, you know, have to make sure that I am, you know, good at this profession and things of that like.
You know, I have to say, you know, I appreciate, I'm going to probably flip that back on you and see what, because I remember reading Panis's book a number of years ago, and I'm interested to sort of hear what your thoughts are. But the word that has come to mind for me most, and I'd say, Ellen, the last 6 months, is this notion of discernment. Because I think there's such a volume of activity, and discernment can't be the only characteristic, because discernment oftentimes has to be mixed with other strengths. Like, for example, you have to be engaging with your donors in a meaningful way in order to discern where this relationship's going to go. So that's what I mean by the notion of discernment. But what I also mean is I think discernment is that ability to sort of like, for example, at the very beginning of an employment relationship, so you're sitting there with the new boss or the new board and you're interviewing for this job, can you discern whether or not that organization actually gets what you're saying when you say, I want to do work that isn't, say, for example, arm's length fundraising?
Right.
Can you sort of read between the lines? So, for example, in the book, I talk about this idea of sort of just drawing a very simple line between initial and subsequent gifts. So there's the first gift, and those gifts sort of play out a particular way, and they generally take on a particular characteristic. And then there's subsequent gifts, which is just everything else. And I think if fundraising professionals want to be set up to succeed, they're going to have to discern that their bosses understand, their prospective bosses understand that it's the subsequent gift where all the joy, all the meaning, and quite honestly, all the margin, just to talk brass tacks, that's where all the actual margin comes from in terms of fundraising actually being able to drive your mission. And so if you're not able to discern with this board or this boss that these people know how to do this, you're perhaps sort of setting yourself up for failure. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think? So let's say, for example, we combine my discernment and Panis's energy. What do you think? What have you learned is sort of that top, what's the one additional characteristic in addition to his energy, my discernment? What would you add to the list?
I would definitely say that you kind of have to be good at, you know, having an imagination and being innovative. And I think anything, like, especially with the way that COVID has impacted everything, I would say being able to pivot and being able to, you know, have those meaningful conversations with your donors. And kind of, I would just say, like, being able to, you know, succeed in the way that you cultivate your donors and like Pena says that you have to have limitless energy. And like now more than ever, we should have limitless energy. But at the same time, you have to be able to cope with the difficulties and stresses and kind of move forward.
Are you in a situation where you've got the opportunity to get on Zoom with donors regularly, for example?
Yes. Yeah, I have. Our donors, our volunteers, we've done that quite a bit through COVID. And I think it's interesting because it presents a new opportunity for you to meet with people that you maybe necessarily wouldn't have before, because virtually, you know, people can find time for a 30-minute conversation rather than traveling or doing what have you to make a meeting. But I think that it's been really good in that aspect of meeting with people from all over the place. We're a very small shop, so it's definitely created an opportunity for sure.
Yeah, because I think the sort of the and I didn't use this, I didn't make this sort of assertion in the first book there, largely because I didn't see COVID coming, for example.
Sure.
But I'm a fan of Zoom and other platforms. I teach a class at the local college, and I've got students that I regularly meet. I'll be in a classroom this evening, a Zoom classroom with 18 students this evening. And one of the things that I think that Zoom, in order to sort of make a clarification on sort of how that relates to arm's length fundraising, because the thing about arm's length fundraising is it's generally done in mass. So it's generally done in large quantities, and it's keeping the relationship at a distance in such a way where there's very little intimacy, because you're talking to literally, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of donors at any given time.
Right.
But if I was trying to discern whether a young fundraiser was actually getting this experience and opportunities that they needed earlier in their career, as it relates to this sort of this current time period, I would want an individual like yourself regularly making eye contact, mm-hmm. you know, eye contact with a donor. And I don't really care who the donor is. I don't care if they're $1 million donor or a $50 donor, but just learn how to make eye contact, which Zoom allows you to do, and make eye contact in order to, you know, communicate with them in ways just like you would generally at a lunch table or a coffee table. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you get those experiences in your work?
Yes, I do. We've had like kind of social gatherings through Zoom where we'll like invite several people to come like for a coffee chat or what have you, and just have people talk. A lot of our donors are connected to the mission through either it being related to their family member or their friend. So we kind of have more candid conversations about that and really just get to know people. We get to know them, and other donors and volunteers get to know each other as well. So it kind of, you know, is a great opportunity for not only us to meet them, for them to meet each other as well in a setting that they may not have had organically pre-COVID.
So it sounds like, in addition to the sort of the excitement that you've experienced thus far doing fundraising yourself, you've also become a big fan of this notion of peer-to-peer,
yes.
which is not a topic that I've talked a whole lot about. We have been sponsored for the last 9 months with by One Cause, and they're a big peer-to-peer platform. And so, so talk to me about what that means, because I think a lot of people sort of miss what that means when we say peer-to-peer.
Sure. I think to me, peer-to-peer means having an individual who's passionate about the mission share their personal story and their connection to the cause. Because, you know, we as fundraisers have our connection and our passions and can tell people, you know, why it matters. But for peer-to-peer, it's so much more personal and so much more, you know, why this matters to them and how, you know, donors can have an impact for their personal, you know, relationship. And I think that speaks volumes to donors as well. Also, because it puts into the person that's doing the peer-to-peer's court, you know, how do I want to solicit these donors? Who am I reaching out to? What am I sharing with them? And I think, that kind of puts it on them a little bit, but also we're there to help them and mentor them along the way to make sure that they are comfortable, you know, approaching people and sharing with them why this cause matters so much.
You know, like I said a few minutes ago, we haven't had a conversation about peer-to-peer fundraising, but is in some ways, it always comes up as sort of a method amongst many that fundraisers are generally using. And so I've never asked this question, but is it essentially a coaching role? Are you sort of coaching along volunteer fundraisers to sort of get the best that they can out of their sort of circle of influence?
Yeah, I would say definitely it has that role. Some people kind of do their own thing. So I've done peer-to-peer where it wasn't necessarily coaching. It was just me kind of like spearheading the whole thing. But I've also talked with people about, you know, say they want to do a birthday campaign or something like that.
Yeah.
Saying, okay, so let's, you know, create some sort of social media campaign around it or an email that you want to send to the people that are close to you. And kind of help them through that language. And because sometimes it doesn't come organically to them, they don't really know what to say. So kind of walking through that process with them, as well as, you know, helping them keep track of their timeline that they're going with. So yeah, I would definitely say it has a bit of coaching to do with it for sure.
Okay. And if I understand that correctly, so that could be that in many cases, that peer-to-peer fundraiser, well, you're the fundraiser, and that's oftentimes that's a volunteer in the seat that you're coaching, mm-hmm. the coachee seat.
Yes.
You're interacting with that individual in a very direct and meaningful way as well, making eye contact, perhaps interacting with them on Zoom as well. Am I right?
Yes, yes.
So in some ways, this could be because I recall in my last employment role, we had with the private school that I worked for, we had this puzzle concept. It was six pieces to a children's puzzle that could be easily put together. We had a very large version of it. And essentially, our development directors, we had a couple of them, would do these puzzle campaigns. And the whole idea was is that, donors would host these, it never occurred to me, but perhaps this is essentially what peer-to-peer fundraising is. They would host these, what we called puzzle parties. And they would essentially present the cause to their circle of friends. And so they introduced, they invited 10 or 12 friends to their homes and hosted these puzzle parties. And the way we use the puzzle is the puzzle with this small sort of version of the puzzle that was, 6 to 8 inches, I guess, that was made out of, nice wood, and you could put a nice little pretty box. And it was sort of the gift that we gave to the host for hosting the party. But the very large version was the one that we used that enabled them to sort of tell the story of the organization. Does that sort of fit the definition of peer-to-peer? If I'm sort of hosting this party and inviting my 10 to 12 friends into the home to get to know this organization that I care about?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because that was the role. So the role that, for example, Michelle and Joanne and Otto and some others on my team, they became the facilitators, the coaches of sort of ensuring that the host, who oftentimes were donors themselves, they were already donors themselves, were getting the job done in such a way where they would come out on the back end of the experience excited and energized and would continue their level of support. Because I have to imagine, and you tell me, I have to imagine that peer-to-peer fundraising can oftentimes let the person down on the fundraising side sometimes. You don't want them to come out on the back end disappointed with the outcomes that they generate. Am I right?
Absolutely, yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
And it also, I think part of the coaching is helping them, along with the time frame, a realistic goal of what they want to do. I've helped people they did a fundraising campaign for one of my family members' elementary schools to raise money for iPads. And they were like, okay, how do we do this? How do we, set a time frame for this? And I said, well, when do you want this project funded by? And, what's your goal? And how are you communicating that goal to people? And are you appealing to parents? Are you appealing to family members, friends, like the local community? What does this look like for you? And kind of having them understand who their audience is and then going from there. And like you're saying, you know, inviting your friends and having that conversation of why this impact is important and things like that. So yeah, no, definitely. It is, it's coaching and it's, you know, managing a little bit, and it's, I really enjoy it. So.
Okay. So you're reading Panis's book. You've read my book. We're in the middle of COVID-19. We've got this crazy election that's coming up. By the time this broadcast, we'll actually know the outcome of this. We hope we'll know the outcome of this election. And you're saying fundraising is going to work for you for the next 20 years. So what do you imagine your career looking like? I mean, what on the back end, what 10 years from now and 20 years from now, what do you sort of aspire to have accomplished?
Well, when we met, you said something that really stuck out to me of how, you know, you want to be the person that's sitting down eating lunch with the person and the donor and having that conversation and creating that connection with them. And I was like, that is what I want to be doing. Like, I want to be meeting with donors. I want to be talking with them. I want to be passionate about the organization that I work for and believe in the mission. And, you know, kind of, you know, radiate that type of energy and enthusiasm that the donor feels as well. Like, it's not me just coming to you for money. It's us, you know, partnering together to move forward with something that we both care about and gauging their interests and things of that like. So I think going down the line, it's just more so of me getting a better understanding. At this point, I've kind of like dipped my feet in different areas of fundraising. I personally love grant writing. I love it. I also like peer to peer. I like meeting with donors. Like, I kind of like all of it. So I would like to do that, but also, you know, as time goes on, hopefully mentor other young professionals and help them understand, you know, how they can move forward in their career and steps that they can take and books that they can read, because it's kind of like whatever you want to put into it and then go, move from there. You know what I mean?
Okay. When I hear somebody say, use the word love, I have studied that word. I've got a number of books that my wife and I, that largely have to do with sort of our personal faith journeys. Mm-hmm. But this notion of love, that's a pretty profound word. So what is it about grant writing in particular that you, when you say you love grant writing, help me understand why that is? Cause I want to see if we can connect the dots and see if that's going to ensure that you're 20 years out still doing this.
Sure. Okay.
We're going to be fortune tellers for the last 10 minutes. We're going to see if Ellen's going to be doing this. And I think it might be embedded in your appreciation for this idea of avoiding arm's length fundraising and understanding what that love is actually all about.
Absolutely. I think for me, for grant writing, it's, you know, articulating the work that you do and showing them, you know, with your support, we can accomplish this. And I think it also has to do with the final report write-up of really showing them the impact that they had and how they've partnered with us throughout the year. And also to that end, I think, you know, it's also about having a relationship with the funder. It's not just creating this proposal and submitting it and thinking, oh, I hope this, you know, sticks, basically. It's like, no, I need to know them. I need to understand, you know, what they're interested in and why their interests and their passions align with our organization. And then moving forward, showing them the impact that they have and maintaining that relationship. Because I think, you know, with arms like fundraising, it makes it extremely transactional. And it's not about the transactional relationship. It's more than that. So to me, grant writing kind of helps you, you know, with written communication, articulate all of those things to the prospective donor and, you know, either see a reward from that or move forward and continue to build the relationship. It's all kind of, you know, pivoting and moving forward. It's not necessarily the first no is always the no for moving forward. It's, you know, kind of being persistent through that.
So if I'm hearing you, if I'm connecting the dots, because this is one of the things I think happens in fundraising. And for someone like yourself who's saying, I want to be doing this in 20 years, I love grant writing, but I want to avoid arm's length fundraising. And to sort of start with, to sort of remind ourselves is what I was starting with about making sure that your boards and your bosses understand exactly what it is you want to be doing in your work. If you tell an employer you want to be a grant writer, they're going to pigeonhole you into this is my critique of what is grant writing. And this is probably not going to come across to you as rocket science, you know, all that shocking. But they're going to pigeonhole you behind a desk. And they're going to, as if you're like my wife, who's a English, you know, English major in college, who enjoys writing, but wants nothing to do with that coffee table. You know, she's not the type who wants to get out and have that coffee table conversation. But I think what grant writing ought to look like, and I hope this is sort of and maybe you've heard me say this before, perhaps even in that book club conversation. But one of my early mentors was this was 25 years ago, and I've repeated this often, and you know, every time the idea of grant writing comes up, he was for a major for a large university up in New York. He said, Jason, I'm a foundation officer. So just like you would describe yourself perhaps as a major gift officer, his job description essentially was a foundation officer. So he had 100 foundations assigned to him, primarily trustees linked to private foundations. And he said, Jason, I have in-person meetings. You know, I have that eye-to-eye contact. I do a handshake proposal, and then I go back to the office and write the proposal. So he essentially negotiates the proposal in person, and then goes back to the office and writes that. And so he had a travel. I remember him explaining to me in this conversation. He said, "I have a travel budget that allows me to travel my region. That's as large as anybody else's in the department in terms, you know, in the advancement department, who's soliciting individual donors or corporate gifts or anything else of the sort." And I think that's what a lot of our quote unquote grant writers are missing, is that commitment to having that eye to eye. Meaningful conversation, even if it's perhaps being done on Zoom, and then going back and doing what, to use your word, articulating what that conversation looks like, you know, or re-articulating what that conversation looked like and putting it on paper for the decision maker. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's not a whole lot different than my colleague and I. We just recently submitted a very significant proposal, a 15-page proposal to a prospective client who wants to work on a very large capital campaign. We had a very meaningful conversation. In fact, we've had two meaningful conversations, one of which involved eye-to-eye contact on Zoom. But then we turn around and we put together this proposal that sort of re-articulates, hey, we heard you. This is what we're doing. This is what we think sort of aligns, and this is where we'd like to go. I think that's sort of perhaps the future of fundraising, if we sort of, or grant writing in particular, if we sort of see it through the lens of avoiding that arm's length. Is that what you could fall in love with, or is that essentially what you're in love with now?
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, it's both. Like, I could, and I do like that now. Yes, I think it does stem from that initial conversation and having those conversations prior to the proposal, because, I mean, more likely than not, you're not going to get a grant that you're just shotting into the dark for. So it is, you know, all about creating those relationships, making that eye contact with the face-to-face, and, you know, putting a face to a name instead of being an email or an open proposal.
The other thing that excites me, so you're less than 5 years in, am I right?
That is correct.
Okay. I've got a roundtable conversation that I'm doing with a sort of like a seniors, not seniors as in older people, but seniors as in most experienced in the AFP club. I've got a conversation coming up. And what most excites me about your generation is that at some point you're going to be 10 years in, maybe even sooner than this, but you're going to be 10, 15 years in, and somebody's going to give you the obligation and the opportunity of supervising. Mm-hmm. And I think the real exciting thing is that we're going to see people who've been sort of shaped and formed differently, professionally speaking, through what it means to be a fundraiser than sort of the current guard of fundraising supervisors had a very different path and oftentimes had loyalties to other professional domains. They originated in advertising, marketing, PR, other places. They weren't fundraisers from the beginning of their careers. And so someone like yourself who's saying, I love this type of work. I want to get in front of the donor. I want to make eye contact. I get arm's length fundraising. I understand, facilitating the conversation onto a proposal. Do you think supervision would be something that you would aspire to as well, being able to supervise a team of individuals like yourself?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I would love to just help foster their growth and help them understand, you know, like how you ask me, is this something you want to do in 10 years? And how can we figure out that that is, you know, it does align with your future goals? And I think that's something I would love to do for a young professional at some point, as well as give them the resources to help them, learn what they can and grow professionally to be good at what they want to be good at.
Yeah, I've got to, I won't name her name. A lot of people in the space know who I'm talking about because I reference her often, but she's at Children's Hospital now in Philadelphia, and she's probably in her, I don't even think she's, at the oldest, she's in her early 40s, and she has a career path that's very similar to yours. She, right out of college, she started in fundraising, knew it was something that she wanted to do. I want to say she's managing a team of frontline fundraisers now, probably 20 plus fundraisers, and she is dynamic. And she's awesome. And she's a woman. And I think that's part of why she's so great at it. I think women are much better supervisors in some cases when it comes to this work. I definitely want to introduce you to her, Ellen. Is there any sort of final point that we can sort of wrap up on? I've really enjoyed this conversation. You've given me a lot of space to chatter. But what's sort of a parting thought that we can wrap up on?
I would just say that to be aware of your organization or you as a fundraiser doing arm's length fundraising and making sure that moving forward, you know, as you said, articulating to, you know, your ED or your board of making sure that, you know, you are aware of the practices that you're doing and why you care about creating that connection and not doing arm's length fundraising and either doing that in grant writing or doing that in peer-to-peer, you know, it can be carried all across the sector. So I think that is one huge takeaway, as well as, you know, being persistent, having that high level energy and going through this, knowing that there are a lot of really wonderful people in this sector that are willing to help you and, you know, mentor you. And, you know, as a young professional, it's really encouraging.
Ellen, I've got to give my, I got to, because you appreciate the notion of arm's length fundraising, I got to put kudos out to my editor, Cindy. Cindy worked with me on that first book project that we're referring to. She's working with me on the one that I'm wrapping up now. And, arm's length fundraising was her word. So kudos to really good editors. If you ever write, Ellen, if you ever write a book, hire a really good editor to help you get. So I write the rough stuff. I write the actual material. She's not ghostwriting it for me, but she takes it and turns it into something that is eloquent and refined and sounds like somebody who actually knows what they're doing. And she was working on those first couple of chapters and she said, Jason, you need to coin this term. And so it's very encouraging to be sitting down with you today and hearing that arm's length fundraising really clicked for you. So kudos to Cindy for that, for doing that for us. Ellen, if somebody is listening today and they want to continue a conversation with you, perhaps they're curious about some particular part of your path, they want to talk to you about peer-to-peer fundraising or grant writing or sort of your take on something in our space, how would you suggest that they reach out to you?
I am available via email. My personal email is eskala24@gmail.com. I check my email all the time. I'm an email junkie, so that is definitely the best way to get to me.
Ellen, it has certainly been a pleasure. I would enjoy having you back anytime. All you've got to do is have a big idea or bold opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.